Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Alex Berenson. I remember reading his first book, The Faithful Spy, his first John Wells novel back in 2006, and loving it. And now I think there are 12 books in that series.
12 John Wells novels, yeah.
12. And today we're going to be talking about his new standalone novel, The Power Couple, which I read over the holidays, completely loved. It's a Book Reporter Bets On selection. Welcome, Alex.
Carol, thanks so much for having me.
So let's start. Why a standalone novel now?
Well, you know, 12 novels, a lot of novels with the same, sort of characters and world. And, first of all, John Wells, look, I love John Wells. He's been actually an important part of my life for the last 15 years. I've punished him a lot. He's been through more than any person should have to endure. But really, as you go further with a character, it's almost like the character is alive, and the freedom of action you have with them starts to fall. Like, the character gets older and has a real history, and unless you're going to completely ignore that, the character becomes somebody who has a groove in his life, just like, you know, it's just like real life. So that was one reason. And then with big espionage novels, I think it's actually harder to do than with a crime. You know, if you're writing police thrillers, a murder, look, murder is a murder is a murder in a way. I mean, obviously I'm oversimplifying, but the police officer doesn't have to save the world every time. Mm-hmm. So you can have a satisfying story that doesn't involve really high stakes, that, you know, it doesn't have to be a serial killer every time. It can be a well-told story of a single murderer, it doesn't even have to be a murder. With espionage, big genre espionage, the stakes want to be high every time. And and there's only so many times John Wells can save the world. And if he's not doing that, I sometimes would hear from readers like, oh, this mission sort of wasn't worthy of him. And so that was something that I felt like after 12 of these, he needed a break, I needed a break. And so I wanted to do something else. And then specifically with this, I wanted to write, see if I could write a female protagonist. And, there are really three main characters in The Power Couple. There's Rebecca, Brian, and then their daughter, Kira. And so two of those three characters obviously are female. And so that's a different feel than the Wells novels. The Wells novels are sort of very stereotypically, he's the man alone, he has to save him, you know, he's saving the world. And yes, there are women in the books, but it's a very male dominated world. And I really wanted to write a world that was, you know, that had a female character in it. And also a character who was, Rebecca's trying to survive in the FBI, which is a male dominated world. So can she do that? And what does she have to give up to do that? And the fact is she's very good at it. And it works for her, but in some ways she realizes towards the end of the book that she has given up some time with her family, that she has it hasn't been cost free for her. And I think that's a little bit of an undercurrent in the book. And honestly, the thing that I'm happiest about in the book is that, so far it's gotten a lot of reviews on Goodreads, and most of those reviews are from women. You know, women tend to, you know, they read more fiction than men. They read more domestic thrillers than men. And the women who reviewed the book, they don't all love it. Some like it, some like it a lot. Some don't like it as much. But almost nobody has said, hey, these women don't feel real. Mm-hmm. You know, this feels like a man wrote this, and, you know, he just wrote a Barbie, and, you know, and it's stupid, and it didn't work at all that way. These women are real, and they're complicated. And I mean, Brian's complicated too, obviously, but I felt, and I feel really good that that's been the response from female readers.
Mm-hmm. I would completely agree. So when we open the book, the family's on this idyllic vacation, the vacation I would like to be on, and it implodes as Kira, their college age daughter, is abducted. And while it seems like it's random act, we start to learn it's not quite what it seems. And then our antennas start to go up as readers. It's like immediately, like, wait, what's going on here? Your plotting here is completely propulsive. Did you do that in advance or do you wing it with the book?
No, I did it in advance. I always outline my books in advance. I know there's a few people who don't. I know Lee Child, for example, doesn't. And sometimes I think, you know, you can get to really, if you're really good and you do it that way and you can really walk the tightrope, you can, I think, write books that maybe are more surprising because there's, you know, because you really didn't know what you were doing going in. And so it can be totally surprising. I think, unfortunately, for most people who, you know, who aren't Lee Child, and even sometimes with Lee, you can see sometimes he kind of writes himself into a corner and has to just kind of like pull something out of a hat to get out. But for me, I'm terrified that I would write half a book and not know where to go. So when people tell me, you know, when people write me and ask me, oh, I'm a, you know, first time novelist and I don't know what to do, or, you know, I don't know if I should outline, I always say outline, you know, I think, again, you can lose a little bit of spontaneity, but you gain assurance that you know where you're going.
That's a good line. That's a really good line. By the way, Lee's brother is now taking over writing the books and he's outlining. I can't do this wing and a prayer.
I mean, it is amazing that he is able to write those books with no outline.
Yeah. It's like, well, they get stuck in the bathtub once in a while too. You know, can't figure out how to get out. So the storytelling is first told by Rebecca and then by their daughter and later by Brian. And I really thought I knew what was going on till I hit the Brian section about page 209.
Yeah.
The story completely flips. And was there always a plan? I guess there was a plan to always tell one story first and then the other, because really, I only knew one point of view of a little bit from Kira at that point.
Yes. So, I mean, that was my plan there. You know, I don't want to say I stole it from Gone Girl, but I kind of stole it from Gone Girl in that, I mean, you know, that book is extremely brilliantly plotted, obviously. I mean, that, you know, with the that's Wheels Within Wheels Within Wheels, where you have the, you know, you have the game that Amy's playing. And then the intentional birthday game she's playing. So, and all those things add up, but broadly you sort of hear from her and then you hear from him. And I thought that worked really well. And I wanted to do something like that. The difference in this is it's intercut with the kidnapping, right? So you have Kira who's sort of, you know, she's sort of in her own world, but she, you know, she knows her parents as well as anybody. So you're getting a taste of what she thinks the marriage was like too, but mainly you're seeing it from Rebecca's point of view. And then suddenly you see it from Brian's point of view. And it's not that either of them is lying. I don't like stories where the narrator is so unreliable. I mean, the narrator can be unreliable about his or her emotions, but I don't like stories where the narrator lies to the reader. Because I think in fiction, you're trying to craft a world that is consistent, that people can believe in. And when you have a narrator who just suddenly pulls the rug out and says, I told you something that's completely untrue, it's a reminder of the artificiality of the world that you're inhabiting. And so I don't like that. So these characters don't lie, but they have their own view of the situation. And, you know, Rebecca doesn't know everything that Brian's doing and Brian doesn't know everything that Rebecca's doing. And so there are secrets, but there are not really lies. And so I did want it to be, you know, I did want the Brian section to be a surprise without it being based on lies, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Brian's section starts with this line. Brian was taking it easy this winter. Okay. You play that back like later on. And I felt like that line is a perfect start for us to be introduced to him. And the scene is back even before they met. And from the very few paragraphs right there, we see Brian completely differently than what we had seen Rebecca presenting along the way. Yes. And so when I got there, was that the line like right from the beginning or did you go back and write that one?
No, that was his, you know, his, it's interesting that you thought that was such a seminal line. I mean, he is, as he says at one point, his great sin is that he's lazy. You know, he is a smart guy, but he's lazy and he's not really sure what he wants to be. And so he comes upon this woman who's, you know, she's pretty and she's driven and she's smart and she's sort of in a completely different social class. I mean, you know, it's not that she's a billionaire or anything, but as he says, she's from this sort of Northeastern, you know, snobby intellectual class. And he's, you know, he's from the Midwest. And so it's not exactly that he's intimidated by her, although secretly he is a little bit, But he allows her to draw him in. And in earlier drafts of the book, and actually, you know, Simon Schuster, I think, correctly told me to sort of tone down the sex. There's still sex in the book, but it was more clear that, you know, the number one thing that he was offering is that he's a real player. Like, he's very, you know, he's very self-assured sexually. And this is, you know, not exactly something that she's had before, and she really likes it. And they kind of, you know, they kind of have a very, very sexual relationship at the beginning. And for better or worse, that kind of relationship can hide deeper problems, especially if you wind up getting married quickly and having kids quickly. It's sort of like before that first real wave of sex has faded, you're together. And so Brian, you know, Brian's part of the bargain is, you know, I'm going to let this woman sort of take over, and you know, I haven't been motivated. I'm smart, but I'm a little bit lazy, and I'm okay with that. And then it turns out as time goes on that he's kind of less and less okay with that. And at the same time, you know, Rebecca, who should have had a better idea of who he was, you know, gets more and more aggravated over time that from her point of view, he's not pulling his weight. I mean, it's been funny to me to read some of the, you know, again, because I do like to read the Goodreads reviews, because, you know, it's really, it's not critics, it's folks just reading and telling you what they think. The Goodreads reviews have said, I don't like either of them, a fair number of people have said, and I that's surprising to me, because, you know, I certainly, you know, I don't think Rebecca is dislikable, and I think Brian, you know, to some extent, he has his own issues, obviously, but you see where he's come from and how things are not always easy for him. So, but especially with Rebecca, I'm surprised people say they don't like her, because she's tough, but I don't think she's a bad person.
No, I don't either. You know, and then Brian creates this app and sells it for a lot of money.
Yes.
And that makes him worth more, though, in Rebecca's eyes, because yes, all of a sudden he's pulling his weight, like he's not just sitting around the house. So finances and who contributes to the marriage financially can be really tricky. And yes, it's a lot bigger than socks on the floor. I mean, it's a bigger.
Yes, and I, you know, and I think that's something you don't hear about that much in novels. You know, there's especially in sort of, you know, a lot of commercial fiction that's, you know, that's set in upper middle class suburbia, or, you know, it's, there's this, the bills just get paid. Everything is okay. And you never really have to worry about anything. Well, the, you know, these people make, they may, you know, Rebecca makes decent money. She's, you know, she's an FBI agent. She's not, they're not broke, but money is a constant problem for them. Mm-hmm. And actually that's probably the most transactional moment in the book for Rebecca, is this idea that, you know, when he sells this thing and makes this money, that she feels better about him. I mean, that is a little bit of an ugly side of her personality that she doesn't really want to admit, but you see very clearly that he sees it. But yes, the money is an issue in the book. And I, you know, I wanted it to be, I didn't want this to be, you know, easy. And I also, you know, but I didn't want it to be, oh, you know, we're so poor, we're living hand to mouth. No, it's decisions that they make, or especially that Rebecca makes, that make their lives more difficult financially.
Mm-hmm. It's the car she buys. It's, but then when they move from one location to the other, it's more expensive. We yep. can't buy a house. We had a great house and down here. We can't have it over here. And that's where it really starts to play. I mean, when she's yep. outside the belt line, and then yes. all of a sudden she's like, wait a second, what have we done with our lives? You know, yes. where are we going? So, but we've got the marriage, we've got the espionage story. And I've just got to add the line, was there always a plan to marry the two?
yes, there was. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to see if I could write a book that was part domestic thriller and part, you know, sort of a more traditional kidnapping / espionage book. And, you know, I think in the cover letter that Simon Schuster sent out, I had this line that I thought was really, you know, I you know, it's a little, it's almost too clever for its own good, but I did think it was clever. It's this idea of, you know, a marriage is, it's him, it's her. I mean, this is every marriage. It's him, it's her. And then the marriage is almost its own thing, mm-hmm. right? The dynamic of a marriage. So, you know, I'm not talking about a year, but I'm talking about a marriage that's been 10 years or more, and there's kids and there's a real relationship, whether it's good or bad. It's almost a third party, you know, with the people. And so that's kind of what the book is, right? There's the domestic thriller, the story of the marriage. There's the kidnapping, the story of the, you know, of Kira and what's happened to her. And then there's the interplay and how those two things come together and make a third story.
Yeah. You're married 10 years. I'm married 35. And it's, you're capturing what a marriage is like through the years too, because what you're doing is you're charting this course of it, whatever, and their responsibilities are changing. And we're seeing it from both of their points of view. And that's what I really loved. On the page, they're spilling how they feel, but I think there are a lot of harbored thoughts here. Like, yeah. And you're going internal with them too, so we can hear the harbored thoughts that aren't just coming through on the dialogue.
Yes. So, you know, the book breaks, you know, sort of the great rule of commercial fiction is you don't go too back, you know, you don't have too much backstory. You're always moving forward. You don't have too much internal, you know, monologue. I mean, look, I didn't want to write that book. I wanted to write a book that is more about these characters and that you do, you know, you do see them grow and change. I mean, it's funny. The book in some ways is 2 days long, right? It's the story of this kidnapping that literally unfolds over a 48 to 72 hour period, but it's also a 20 year book. And you know, it's funny, I had been reading the Ken Follett books, you know, the Cathedral books. And he's writing over the course of a century, and, you know, and it's a great treat as an author to be able to write over a, you know, over a long period of time and imagine these characters changing and see them changing. And, you know, and because this is now, you know, sort of 1995 to 2019, essentially the book ends in 2019. There's some cultural stuff about the internet. I mean, these two are both Generation Xers, which I am. And so, you know, these characters are my age, and they, and I got to, you know, sort of relive some stuff in the 90s and in the early aughts, and so that was fun too. But beyond the cultural stuff, the sort of the easy cultural references, the idea of what your life looks like when you're 20 or 23 or 25 versus what it looks like when you're 45 and you have kids, you know, it's something that fiction gets to do.
You know, you mentioned that in a marriage, you marry the past, the person you met, the person you fell for, but you live for the future, the family you've become. It's a really great line. And the questions that you pose from there are thought-provoking. So it's really, you're looking at this marriage in all those different ways. It's who they think they're going to be, what's going to happen. You also noted that marriage is a mirror. So yes. Let's talk a little bit about that. I like that.
So, I mean, that, you know, that's the opening of the book, and hopefully that will draw people in. But it's this idea that marriage, people say, oh, you marry your best friend. But in some ways, you're marrying, you know, over time, you're marrying yourself. You're marrying this person who's always there with you and who knows you and you know, and who knows what's good about you and what's not. I mean, that's what a real relationship. And that's why marriage, you know, when it goes bad, it can go so bad and be so scary, is because, you know, you have this person who knows every weakness, as your own weaknesses as well as you do, and you know her, you know, or his weaknesses as well as he does, and so you can really tear at the other person. I mean, that's when, you know, there's not a lot of secrets, I think, in a marriage that goes on long enough, and if there are, when they come out, they're really devastating. So yes, this idea that it's a mirror. I mean, it's interesting to me because we've been doing nothing but talking about the marriage. If you're going to describe the book in one line, you'd say it's about the kidnapping, but in reality, it's not about the kidnapping. It's actually about the marriage.
Yeah, it is. But then it's also about these two people who are intelligence officers, like they both are, and different sides. He's with the NSA, she's with the FBI. So I just picture they both know how to lie. They both know how to say everything, you know, go in and back. I had a friend who was with the FBI, and he was telling me these great stories about he'd get together for somebody for the CIA, and they tried to say who has what kind of clearance, like what can I tell you? Right. What can I tell you? They wouldn't tell each other's names because you lie like all day long. And he says, you know, basically you go home and you start to have dinner, and you're like, I can just have dinner. I can't do this. But these two each know something back and forth. Have you seen this with characters? Like, what did you study operatives? Did you talk to people?
Well, it's, you know, it's sort of out of Wells. It's that world. I mean, you know, the FBI isn't quite as devious as the CIA, but they, you know, they'll still lie. Like, they'll still run undercover operations, and, you know, police officers and detectives and FBI agents are allowed to lie to people. You know, they're allowed to lie to suspects. You know, if you lie to them, you can get in trouble, but they can lie to you whenever they want. So, you know, Rebecca is, you know, she's a bit of a secret keeper, and so is Brian. And I think you'd have to be a very strong person to be able to leave that in the office entirely, and to, you know, to be somebody who's like completely on the straight and narrow at home, but then you go to the office and you behave completely differently. And I think these jobs, you know, the rate of divorce among both, especially CIA agents, is very high, or CIA, you know, operatives is high. And I think I, you know, you don't have to be, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg, because the kind of person who's drawn to that world is going to be a secret keeper to begin with. But then on top of that, you have this professional ideology of keeping secrets. And I think there's a lot of that.
Yeah. It's like, you know, behind the scenes, what can I say? What can't I say? And what did I really know that if I said, we would have been in a different place? I mean, yes. Think about that too. Responsibility. You know, Tony the Son doesn't have a lot of page time, but when he comes in, he lends a lot of story as a character. Was it always going to be two children?
Tony, to the extent there was an additional something that wasn't in the first outline, Tony was not in the first outline. And so I realized, you know, I thought it would be more, for, he's a little bit of comic relief, a little bit, you know, and it just worked better to have him there, because on some level, it raised the stakes even more, because they don't know, you know, when they don't know what's happened to Kira. So they don't know if Tony is also at risk. So that's an issue for them. And Tony, I think he humanizes both Rebecca and Brian a little bit. You know, it's funny with Kira. So Kira is, you know, Kira's older, and Kira really is in some ways like this perfect mix of the two of them, where she's got the hardness of Rebecca, and in some ways she's got this sort of like, I don't want to say deceptiveness of Brian, but to some extent the deceptiveness of Brian. So she's much tougher than she appears to be, you know, and so when you see her, you see the parts of them that they hide. When you see Tony's more of he's the other half of their personalities. You know, he can be a little bit charming and goofy, as Brian can be at times. And he can be, a simple, not simple is the wrong word, but sort of like a good, straightforward person, as Rebecca can be sometimes. So it was nice to have somebody who, you know, who showed the better, or the, you know, the other sides of their personality. But yes, I did add him. It's interesting that you realized that.
Yeah, it just seemed like he was the perfect foil at some points, like, because yes. He'd sit there and say, wait a second, where is my sister? What's really, and then he gets really worried, but he can have some of the worry that the parents aren't, like, he's articulating both of their minds and what they're trying not to say to each other, he gets to say. That's yes. What I saw. Yes. Yeah, he's allowed to. So at one point, Rebecca goes on a hunt for a clue that she needs about the abduction. It takes her down a really dark rabbit hole. And is she hardwired to like think of the facts objectively at that point, or like, because of who she is at her work, does she just say, I'm going for it?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're sort of talking about late in the story.
Yeah.
No, she's on a mission then. I mean, she wants to know what's really been going on. And, you know, she wants answers, and, you know, and Brian actually wants answers at the end of the book too. He wants some certainty that he doesn't have. And so the two of them are both looking for certainty in their own way. And they both get it, I would say.
Yeah, they both get it. Yeah, I'm not going to give away the ending at all, but it was pitch perfect. I mean, it was just like dead on what happens. Did you always know you're going to rap like that? Even like, did you have that exactly scenario? We're not giving any.
That scenario I did have. That was something that, and it's interesting because oftentimes in the Wells novels, the books would change towards the end for one reason or another. And this time that did not happen. There were things that changed in the middle, but the ending of you know, them being down in the Caribbean months later, that was something I always visualized, and it worked, I think, I hope.
Yeah, no, it completely worked. But here at one point during that scene, a character is ticking through four possible options objectively. She says there's options on paper, but the end, there's one that's really just for the story's sake. You know, it's gonna completely work. But seeing them play through in this character's head, we're not gonna say which one, was really fun to see. It's like, I could do this. And in that scenario, was this one character easier to write? Like who was easier to write? Was a man, the woman, Kira?
I think I think it's interesting. It's hard to talk about this without giving too much away, but you know, one of the things about Rebecca in general is that she's very, she tends to be pretty decisive, mm-hmm. and she knows what she wants and she knows what she's going to do. And there's moments in the book, there's a few moments when that doesn't happen, you know, early on in the book, when Kira is sort of suffering from anorexia or getting close to suffering from anorexia, she doesn't exactly know how to handle that. And so that's painful for her. It's painful for Rebecca when she doesn't know what to do. And with Brian, it's almost the opposite. Most of the time, he's okay. You know, he's happy-go-lucky. He's willing to sort of float. But towards the end of the book, he decides what he wants to do, and he's very decisive about it. And so it's a little bit of a role reversal where Brian knows what he wants more than Rebecca. And so, the two of them have to figure that out together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you're also writing vividly about these scenes in Paris, Barcelona, St. Barts, at a time where we're not traveling anywhere. Like, you know, going to food stores is an experience.
It's
very voyeuristic. How much time do you spend in each city? And
it's funny with the Wells novels. They're set in places like Pakistan and, you know, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. So I decided to be smart and be Daniel Silva and, you know, set this book in places that you'd really want to go, like Barcelona. So, you know, I was in Barcelona. I was in Paris. Barcelona is a great city. And it is funny. You know, because the book really does end in 2019, and I worked out the sort of the timing of it pretty carefully, so you can see, you know, there it really is about 23 years from the time they meet until the end of the book, and you can go through year by year. But normally, the fact that it was published now, you wouldn't, you know, unless you're this kind of person who's really obsessive about the timeline. And I know some people are, but you know, you wouldn't really notice that. You wouldn't notice that the book actually ends a little bit before present day. But because of COVID, you can tell, right? I mean, they are in a pre-COVID world. They are in a world where you can get on a plane and go to Barcelona and you can be in a bar and no masks, nothing to worry about. And in some ways, I was rereading the book, getting ready for the interviews and pub day, and I felt sad. You know, we need to, I hope we can get back to that pretty soon, because, that's a better world.
I want to get down to St. Bart's. I mean, I'm completely there. I'm ready to go.
Yes.
I keep saying to my husband, the first thing we'll do is the Caribbean. I'm like, forget anything else. I don't need to go hiking. I've just working nonstop. I want to go sit on a beach and do nothing.
Yes. You know?
I love the line that this is like the movies Mr. and Mrs. Smith collide with Taken. And I have to say that every January, I feel like a Taken movie came out for a couple of years there. And I just want to say, just don't leave the house. Like, just don't go anywhere. Do you not know what's going to happen?
I'll say one thing, which is that, you know, Kira, I really didn't want Kira to be that character, you know, the younger, you know, the girl in Taken. She's not sitting around screaming her head off. And then just like, oh, they're going to kill me. And, you know, daddy better save me. She wants out, you know, almost from the minute that she's taken, she wants out. And, you know, and by the way, it's not just that she's snatched, like and I think I can sort of give this part away because it's very early in the book. She goes for, you know, she basically allows herself to be taken because she wants to get high, it's not a morality tale or anything. It's just how they managed to take advantage of her. She's aware of that. You know, she kind of got herself in trouble. Not that anybody ever deserves to have anything like this happen to them, but you know, it happened in part because of decisions that she made, and she wants out, and she is willing to figure out exactly what to do to get herself out and to push, you know, and to take risks. And she knows that if she tries to get out and she fails, she might die. But she is, again, she is Rebecca's daughter. She is Brian's daughter. She is not going to sit around waiting for, you know, the helicopter to come save her. And I think there are people who don't like Brian. There are people who don't like Rebecca. Everybody who's read the book thinks that Kira, you know, is a very good, strong character.
And she definitely is. Was this always the title?
No, initially the title was 21. And it's complicated as to why that was, but it had to do with both the app and the fact that the marriage was sort of ending, or, you know, the book was ending on their 21st anniversary. Mm-hmm. And people said, well, 21 is just, it sounds like it's blackjack and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense. So then I thought, well, what about Barcelona? You know, and they said, well, you know, the book is not really, it's set in Barcelona. It's not really about Barcelona. And what's the illustration going to be? And so actually they came up with the power couple. And as soon as they came up with it, I was like, that is the title. That's a really good title. I will say the cover.
Yeah.
If you turn the book to the
side. Yeah, I know. Exactly.
Yep. So that's very cool. There, now on the spine of the book, you'll see those two rings. So one of the suggestions that Simon & Schuster came up with was two rings falling down vertically on the cover of the book instead of the faces. Okay. And okay. I thought that was really cool. I thought that tells you it's a marriage and there's something in this marriage that you don't understand. But their argument was, you know, that doesn't really tell you. The faces are better, basically, and they convinced me of that. But I thought that I'm glad that they have the rings on there, sort of as a reminder, at least to me, of what the cover, you know, could have been.
Could have been. You know, what's really funny is I've been looking at this cover for how long? Like, you know, months now. Months, okay.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, the other day, I went like this, and I was like, oh, I never really looked what was on the bottom. Like, I never made the play. So, readers, you can be smarter than I am. I'm teaching you now. You know. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on mainly, I've become this person about COVID who's become, you know, I've got this, you know, I've spent a lot of time arguing about lockdowns and masks and all this stuff, which we do not have to talk about. And I'm thinking whether I'm going to write a nonfiction book about COVID. After that, I have to figure it out. You know, I have an idea for another nonfiction book that's totally, I won't even go into what it is. And then there's a possibility of a Wells novel. People really want that. And, you know, to some extent, I feel like if I've written 12 of these books, I owe people some kind of ending. Even if the 13th, you know, even if there's going to be no more books after the 13th, there should be some sort of resolution for Wells and Schaefer and Vinnie Dudo and the whole gang. And I have some idea of what that might be, but I'm not sure I want to do it. And then I have one other idea, which actually comes out of something I wrote for the New York Times back in January of 2020, before COVID again, which was all about masks, actually, and the surveillance state. And so it would be a thriller sort of set in 2030 or 2040, where people are wearing masks to defeat surveillance. And there's this, and there are companies that are trying to fight against the surveillance, and they're trying to fight against the people wearing masks, and it would be a big dystopian thriller, basically. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. What's interesting is that's pre-COVID, and now masks have a whole different feel to them.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
I don't know what that book looks like right now. So mm-hmm. I have a couple, you know, so I basically have, is it going to be a Wells novel? Is it going to be this big thriller? You know, is there a possibility of a sequel to The Power Couple? There is. I'm not sure whether that makes sense. You know, do I have another standalone in me? I have choices. I have not started writing any of those. I probably shouldn't tell people that because people really want another Wells novel.
Okay, guys, maybe. Like, maybe you can just, you know, you can just share that. But no, I know. I think that sometimes authors are, they're being comfortable with a character and doing something different that makes you think, what do I want to do with that character next?
Yes.
You know? Have you listened to the audio?
I have. You know, I've never listened to the audio of any of my books, and I should. I've heard actually that the audio is excellent on this. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, you know, the mainly it's voiced by Steven Weber, but Marin Ireland, who's a great actress, who mm-hmm. I've seen on Broadway back when there was Broadway. You know, she's great. She voices just a couple of small sections of it. And so I think that's really cool too. I've never had a book that two people have voiced.
Yeah, I haven't listened to the whole thing. I just listened to a little clip at the beginning, but Marin, she's somebody that we actually run an audio clip at the end of the podcast, and she's done a couple, and it's really a fabulous performance. It's always fabulous. So, well, thank you so much for joining us. It was so great to see you since 2006, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, it's been a long time, and well, thank you. And it's been interesting to me that the discussion, really, we've talked mainly about the marriage and not the kidnapping. And I do think that's what people will, most people will be, who read this book will be getting, you know, and what they'll be focused on. But it's, I hope that the kidnapping, you know, I hope the kidnapping is interesting enough to people also.
The kidnapping is completely interesting to me. And I could talk to you for hours about the kidnapping. My problem is that then I'd be giving things away.
Yes.
And one of my big challenges when I do these interviews is to give nothing away, just get people excited about reading the book. Because we could talk about the kidnapping and we could talk about all the players involved and whatever. Yes. I'm just trying not to, believe me, I'm trying not to spoil it, and it's really hard to do.
You know? Yes, I hear. I mean, I, you know, it's interesting with the kidnapping in that the kidnappers have their own dynamics, right? And they're, yes. You know, they're not married, but there is some back and forth with them too. And so, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but the book really is all about relationships.
It is. And it's also who's the player, who's the lead player in the kidnapping of the kidnappers. There's a hierarchy.
Yes.
And she's also, Kara's trying very quickly to figure out what that hierarchy is.
Yes.
Like who's the one I've really got to play myself out of, and who do I really need to, she's totally trying to figure out the whole, who are these people by just their feet, because she's, you know, blindfolded at points and stuff. It's like, but there's one part where she calls herself Targaryen. And I thought that was pretty funny too.
Yes.
Like, this is what I'm going to do.
Well, Carol, it's been a pleasure. We'll have to do it again before 15 years go by.
I promise. Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Power Couple by Alex Berenson, narrated by Stephen Weber and Marin Ireland, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Catherine Koster. And now listen to an audio excerpt from The Power Couple, narrated by Stephen Weber and Marin Ireland.
Have fun. See you at midnight like we agreed. XXX, Mom. Kira Unsworth swiped left, stung the red delete box. Goodbye. She didn't remember agreeing. She remembered Rebecca saying, midnight, okay? Not okay. Not even close. Even if Jacques didn't show, and Jacques was going to show, she wasn't Cinderella, and she wasn't going to be home at midnight. Not in Barcelona. People came from all over to party here, the ultimate late-night city. She could say the time difference had confused her, though Mom wouldn't bite. Did it confuse your phone, too? Rebecca could smell fibs from 10 feet away. You do remember your dear old mother works for the FBI. Trying to sound like she was joking, though they both knew she wasn't. The words, a challenge. Don't even try it. Mostly, Kira didn't. She'd learned the best lies were the ones she didn't have to tell. Tonight, she would play it cool. No excuses. I'm 19. I'm not a baby. Come on. Dad would be fine, as long as she made it back by 1, maybe even a little later. Good old Bri. Part of him still wanted to be 19, with his microbrews and Nirvana t-shirts. Even Bex would lighten up once Kira got back to their Airbnb. She knew midnight was ridiculous. Ridiculous, Kira mouthed at the girl in the mirror behind the bar. The room around her was long and dark and stuffed with torn leather couches and paintings of long-gone Europeans that had been covered in graffiti and sliced up. The net effect was a castle post-zombie apocalypse, but with better music. MGMT shading into 21 Pilots, shading into Fleet Foxes. Even the occasional band Kira didn't know, and she knew just about everything. She loved new music. She loved music, period. The bar was called The Mansion. Lots of Barcelona bars had English names and was supposed to be one of the coolest places in the city, though it was still mostly empty. Kira should have been intimidated to be here alone. She was, a little, but she felt more confident than she'd expected, probably because she already knew she was meeting someone. She was drinking sangria from a battered copper cup, dark and sweet, and it didn't seem to have much kick, but she felt soft after one drink. She tipped the dregs into her mouth and set the cup down. The bartender slid over. He had wide, dark eyes, nice arms poking out from his black t-shirt. "One more?" Everyone in Europe insisted on talking to her in English. Of course, not too many Spaniards had blue eyes, but couldn't she pass for German, Swedish? They all knew she was American before she opened her mouth. "Stella, por favor." She didn't want to be drunk when Jacques got here. "Try the Estrella. It's local. Better." She nodded. The bartender turned around, leaned over the mini-fridge. He rummaged around a little longer than he needed to, made sure she had time to check out his cute butt in his cute black jeans. At last, he pulled a brown bottle, popped the top with a flourish. "First time in Barcelona?" "First night in Barcelona. Where is everyone?"
"Only 10:45, you'll see."
"Okay.
First night, the cerveza, you don't pay."
He tapped his chest. "Thank you." He winked. "American girls are good for business." She sipped her beer, washing the sticky sangria from her mouth. Nice to be in a country where she could drink legally, no fake IDs, no frat basements. Civilized. Her phone buzzed. A text from a number starting with 33. The country code for France, as she'd just learned. Jacques. Though she hadn't put his name in her phone, he'd have to earn that. "See you soon." "Here," she typed, then deleted it. She didn't want to seem too eager, though she was.